Accession number 28528, reel 18.
Tony Paulson, reel 17.
Include the red. His complete disregard of his personal safety and his devotion to duty, Crush was an outstanding inspiration to his platoon. Not until his forward company was withdrawn on the completion of its task did he consent to receive medical treatment for his wounds. What a performance that was. One of my less fortunate fellow Winchester cricketers was Michael Wellman, a lieutenant with me in 10RB. In the early fighting at Buerada, his scout car ran over a mine, overturned on him, and cost him a leg. John Gamble, my son Anthony's godfather and housemaster, also suffered a leg wound which left a permanent injury. He'd experienced the long and short of war as a KRRC officer in their 2nd Battalion. The long started in March 1943. John sailed from Avonmouth with another friend, Sandy Stowe, and a draft of 18 other Green Jacket officers, not realizing that for the next 8 months he would be more on a tourist trip than battle stations. The first port of call was Freetown. There they anchored for a week, during which he was the powerful anchor man for his tug of war team, which won the inter-draft competition. Then on to Durban for 48 hours before being re-embarked on another ship, bound for Bombay. There they were disembarked, only to be re-embarked immediately on a ship which took them at last to Suez. By then the African war was over and the Sicilian campaign nearly so. Six officers from John's draft were ordered to join either 1st or 2nd Battalion KRRC. He and Sandy both went to 2nd Battalion. For almost 3 months they remained near Tripoli, doing very little except swimming in the Mediterranean. In early September they were ordered to move to Bizerta, where they took ship yet again, this time for Taranto in Italy. By then the Germans had been forced back some 100 miles or so. John's company spent the next 6 weeks moving slowly north, but never less than 10 miles behind the front. By mid-November, 2nd Battalion had closed up on the Sangro River, across which 78th Division had established a bridgehead. Torrential rain had, however, turned the water into a flood, which prevented the sappers from building a bridge to arrange for tank support for them. So instead it was 2nd Battalion who were ordered to ford it, launching John into his all-too-brief battle experience. He thus described the short of it. In mid-afternoon of 21st December, we received orders to cross the river that night and launch an attack on German positions next day. At 400 hours, with six understrength platoons, all that was available, I waded through the waist-high water while it was still dark. At 6:30, there was a heavy barrage, which seemed to me to fall well short of German positions. Our attempted attack got nowhere. My platoon was soon separated from the rest. One of my section commanders and a rifleman were killed as we withdrew. I was then shot in the hand and shortly afterwards in the ankle. That left me unable to walk, so I had to stay there until dark, when a stretcher party came for me. The medical officer did what he could for my foot, and I was then carried back on a stretcher in the dark through the swollen river. This was the most alarming part of the whole experience. Had the rifleman slipped and dropped me in the river, I would certainly have drowned. I was then passed through a series of casualty stations and a hospital in Bari before having my foot amputated in a hospital in Sicily. I was then flown to another in Philippeville, where I had a second amputation. Then I was back to Avonmouth, whence I had set sail almost a year earlier. I reached it in bar another hospital in Algiers, then a hospital ship. Back in England, I phoned Daddy Stowe, the master of Horace Hill School, where I'd been, and father of Sandy Stowe, to tell him there was a rumour that the battalion in which both Sandy and his brother Jimmy were serving might be coming home. Happily, Daddy Stowe then laughed and said the rumour was accurate for once, but outdated, as both were already home. The much-travelled battalion's recall was to prepare for D-Day, with Sandy later wounded in the Normandy fighting. Sandy Stowe's thigh wound left him lame for the rest of his life. To receive it 2 months after landing, he must have travelled a record distance to deliver a flank attack. That army maxim, the longer way round is often the shortest way there, can be sensible, but not if you have to travel 20,000 miles to deliver the attack, as Sandy did. For in addition to the vast number of miles John Gamble covered before confronting the Germans, Sandy had been sent on a signals course in Cairo. By the time that finished, the African war was over and his battalion gone. So he had to travel the 3,000 miles or so to Algiers to get a ship home. Then there was the final short voyage to France before meeting up with the enemy for the first time. But this war was total war, and not solely about artillery and infantry, armoured divisions and paratroops, Navy and Air Force, Bevin boys in the pits, and women in musician factories. It was indeed total war, involving the whole country and whole families. As a teenager, my wife-to-be, Hilary Bassett, witnessed it involve her parents and then herself and her younger sister, Tarn. Her memories remain indelible too. My parents' 7-acre holding was just meadow or garden, but with the U-boat menace beginning to threaten our supplies, my parents responded immediately to the government drive for improved home food production. Part of the meadow was ploughed up for growing vegetables and fruit. They also began keeping pigs and cows on the rest. At the start of the war, Tarn and I had been sent to stay with a godparent in Ireland, then to Dr. Williams School in Wales. At school there, we took part in girls' training corps activity, including drilling in a uniform, and having to learn things that it was thought might be of help if we joined the services, like first aid and Morse code. I was 13 in 1940, and in holidays from school, we were expected to help daily on the farm my parents were running. This had earned official approval, and we had been assigned a land girl at government expense. Needless to say, we were only too happy to do this work, especially as we were told it was helping the war effort and the Dig for Victory campaign. Tending the pigs was something about which I had mixed emotions. The ferocious old sow scared me at times with her aggressive looks and horrendous bellows, so that I was glad to have a rake as a protective weapon as well as for clearing out her sty. Another bad-tempered pig we called Florida. That was where Brother John was training on mustangs, and he was always in our thoughts. We should really have given that name to a sweet-tempered pig christened Stella, for John himself was very kind and even-tempered, and my hero at the time. The boar Montmorency was a real character. Tarn and I used to ride on his back. On one occasion we had to hop on our bicycles and pedal like mad down our narrow lane before we reached the main road as he went in search of pastures new. As for the cows, I found it therapeutic and calming to milk the lovely Jersey. Not so with a black cow we called Dusky Liz, who was a real rogue. She would wait until the pail was full, then try and put a foot in it or kick it over. In the end, we had to bind her back legs together before we started. Towards the end of the war, I also gave a hand to the neighbouring farmer, but found hay raking very heavy work and never felt completely safe when driving tractors on slopes. We were delighted to make a contribution to the war effort, but overall our war work was more a fun experience. My father also kept up his home guard activities, which in time became more general help in the community than expectation of invasion. So did my own father Guy in true Dad's Army style and in tune with its theme song, Mr. Brown goes off to town in the 821, but he comes home each evening and he's ready with his gun. While Mother remained very active with her WVS duties or requests from me to contact a rifleman or whatever, Guy used to go daily to work in London, even at the height of the Blitz. His train was somewhat earlier than Mr. Brown's, and he would arrive punctiliously at Hildenborough Station at least a quarter of an hour before it was due. The one game at which he was never any good and which he desperately tried to master was golf. This allowed him time to go to the end of the platform and practice his swing with a rolled umbrella. When our Wolfden report on sport, in which I was involved, was debated in Parliament, Lord Longford advised middle-aged men to give up games at which they had been good and could only get worse, and try new ones at which they could only get better. Sadly, Father never did get better. While his brief army experience when an undergraduate had not been promising, he was very active in his home guard duties, masterminding, among other things, a guerrilla hideout in Penshurst Wood with a cache of food and weapons. It was optimistically intended to be a launch pad for ambushes. The home guard would never have made much impact had the Germans invaded. Its real significance was in its outward show of the unity and determination which saved us when America and the rest, and even Lord Halifax and the like here, thought defeat inevitable and that we should surrender rather than fight on. End. Finishing off with... Tony Pawson's army career. I was born on the 22nd of August 1921 at Chertsey, Surrey. In 1937, I had my first army experience when I joined Winchester College's army training and helped my house there, B House, to win the recruit cup with a four-man squad, despite my slicing my wrist to the tendon while fixing bayonets. Also, I was in the 20-man squad in 1939, which won drill cup for my Winchester house in the inter-house competitions. Immediately after Dunkirk, the volunteering age was lowered to 19, and so I volunteered at once. It was many months before I got the letter requiring me to report to Peninsula Barracks in Winchester, roughly on the day of the scare of the probable sea lion invasion, when we were stood to happily unnecessarily. Soon after, I was recommended for OCTU and passed the test with 20 others. 10 of us were then chosen to go to Tidworth for further training while waiting to be sent to OCTU. Two later groups then came and went until one of our group's father, General Lentaine, found out that the hut with our records in it had been burnt down, and so we had ceased to exist as OCTU candidates as far as the army was concerned. General Lentaine soon got things back on track, and we were rapidly transferred to OCTU in the Isle of Man, being billeted in the seafront of Douglas. I was past the selection there and returned to Tidworth after commissioning, together with James Wilson, later General Sir James, where we ran the so-called demonstration platoon, which was meant to be good enough to demonstrate anywhere. In 1942, after embarkation leave, I was sent to... In 1942, after more training at Tidworth, I was sent to join 10th Rifle Brigade in the 6th Armour Division in Scotland. We sailed to Tunisia in November 1942 after embarkation leave, and by then I was a lieutenant. After landing and when the fighting started, I was second in command there to C Company's Dick Fife. Later, I was posted to A Company, and during the fighting, altogether had five different company commanders. After the battle, battles in Tunisia, we had a year's break, at the end of which, I believe that was the timing, I was promoted to be captain and second in command of A Company under Major Jim Wilson, who later won the DSO when we landed at Naples. I stayed as captain throughout the Italian campaign, but for a month or so was in charge of A Company when Jim Lonsdale was in hospital after being wounded. Shortly after the end of that campaign, and with peace declared, I was promoted again to being a temporary acting unpaid major. For a time in Austria, I was second in command to James Booth, with whom I started and finished as my company commander. But very shortly, I was put in a charge of a company myself and remained in charge of, firstly, a rifle brigade company out at Lavermond beside the Drava River on the border between Austria and Yugoslavia, which we had to keep there. Later on, as more and more troops were demobbed, and because the demob arrangements were based more on age than length of service, so that I stayed on for over a month before being demobbed, I was put in charge of a company in a Welsh regiment. So altogether, I did more than a year as major in charge of a company, but with the end of the war, naturally, the economics became a major concern, particularly after all that had been spent in the war, and so I was kept as temporary acting unpaid major until I was demobilized over a year later. Of course, that didn't mean that I wasn't paid at all, merely that they couldn't cough up enough money to pay the extra between being a captain and a major, but it was certainly a very long temporary acting. It is 65 years ago since I started my training at the rifle depot, so anything I say or think is very long out of date now, be of any interest. At the time, I thought the basic trainings were very good, but not very imaginative. As a little oddity, I also thoroughly disliked the fact that we had periods of compulsory boxing, at which I was more likely to be sponge bag than hitting the other chap. But certainly I was very quick on my feet and managed to avoid much contact until I was taken aside and very forcibly told that the object of the exercise was not to avoid getting punched, but be getting punched in order to toughen you up and also to try and teach you to become fighting mad when you had an opponent, all of which seemed to me rather stupid at the time. The next thing, that as we progressed from the depot in Winchester to better training, wider training in Tidworth while waiting to go to Octu, I thought that there was not enough night training or tactical training, though at least we again were well taught basics like map reading and compass reading, and even we were meant to be taught, I think quite rightly, motorcycle riding. But I was such a bad motorcyclist that in the actual war I preferred to be pillion rider to my exceptionally good dispatch rider, Rifleman Kent. In Scotland, at least, the importance of tactical training was realised, but the problem then was that most of the tactical training had been handed down from where the only wars had been, or where the only fighting had been, namely in the desert. And the tactics handed down were certainly not the right ones for where we had to fight. And when I went to Octu before being commissioned, the same applied, because the Isle of Man was not really suitable terrain either. The result of that was that we learnt a wrong formation, for instance, of the box formation with the soft vehicles in the middle of a screen of tanks. And that was fine when driving fast in the desert and when being difficult to target by the guns. It cost us 40% casualties in my company when we charged a strongly held mountain with several, with a lot of artillery support and a vast minefield in front of it. So it is obviously vitally important to keep up to date with the tactics taught. Fortunately, in Scotland, that was partly remedied, because certainly the weather, where it rained all the time, was very much what we would have to face when we fought in Tunisia. And the tactics of a 3-day full exercise with briefings afterward was in fact very important, and at least one lesson I learned when I was criticised for not speeding up my carriers when told I was under artillery fire came in for great use later at the end of the Tunisian campaign. No training can really prepare you for war itself, which is when you learn fastest and best if you survive. But I have to say, from my view now, that I don't think that this endless succession of minor wars under the government has been particularly helpful to training of any kind. And one does wonder if the soldiers are in fact taught, which was a lesson that certainly didn't seem to have been taught before the Iraq invasion, of how to cope with a civilian, often a civilian enemy in civilian clothes and with plenty of weapons, much as Brother Philip had to do in Greece. And the other thing that I noted in my own training, in the failure to keep up to date with technical advances and equipment, well, that never once till in Tunisia I was sent on a brief mines course did any of us have any training or understanding of the importance of mines or how they might be booby-trapped or anything to do with that. So by and large our own training that I remember was basically quite good, but it was unimaginative in the early stages, particularly with no night training, which was to play such a major part in so much of my war experiences. So far as looking back in memory at what I think now, it might be interesting to record a discussion, or parts of a discussion I had, when a friend who had bought a copy of my book on my indelible memories of battlefields and playing fields asked me for a drink, and her husband started to quiz me rather forcefully on how I could possibly write a book about having killed people. That did make me think for a moment, but by and large, looking back, first of all, there was nothing else we could do at the time. Secondly, I feel that I was very lucky to have gone with a motor battalion rather than with the ordinary infantry who made the major bigger attacks. So really, though, we had a lot of scouting and minor engagements, we hardly ever had one of these massive face-to-face engagements where you are perhaps bayoneting somebody or somebody is bayoneting you. And I think that was a quite different and much more depressing experience, and probably also they had much greater casualties than we did. Secondly, of course, this was a war which had total civilian support, unlike the recent wars, and that therefore all one thought about was that one had to do it not just to save your own future life, but also to save that of your country. And I have a major feeling now that there was hugely more patriotism in those days than there is with our very mixed society now. And finally, of course, we were not the people who had started the war, and we were not the people who had spread it in trying to get major conquest, or the people who committed vast crimes, vast war crimes, as did the Germans. So I feel no regret whatever, and one also feels some pride that even though you had to endure the unendurable, we did our best and we did win through for our country and against all the odds. It was, of course, also one thing that surprises me is that somehow I managed to survive. When I think back, well, there's nothing except when I nearly lost my leg on that tank that has ever given me even a momentary nightmare, as that very occasionally did. I think back on the innumerable close escapes that had to involve a bullet through my forage cap, nearly losing my leg, orders like had the 10th Panzer arrived in time at Kasserine, I would have certainly been either killed or captured, and a whole series more like that. So it's just, and again, the shell which pitched on my parapet, and an incredible number of near misses, and one wonders how on earth the odds were defeated and you won through. And in my case, of course, Brother Philip fought in France, and he fought from the start in North Africa. He was at Alamein, he was through to the surrender in Tunisia, he fought in Greece, and he fought all the way up Italy, and he was never even wounded.